Kyra's parents met over a keg of beer stuck in a mud hole. Maddie was running the usual Tuesday night keg out to the softball field from the main building on a handcart. She'd gotten it most of the way from the restaurant wing with no trouble, but there had been heavy rain earlier in the week, and the cart finally bogged down in a soft spot. Lance's team was up, and Lance was sitting at the end of the bench, waiting his turn to hit. He saw the girl in the white shorts and blue Warrington's polo shirt struggling with the bogged handcart, and got up to help her. 3 weeks later, they were inseparable, and Maddie was pregnant. 10 weeks later, they were married. 37 months later, Lance DeVore was in a coffin, done with softball and cold beer on a summer evening, done with what he called woodsing, done with fatherhood, done with love for the beautiful princess. Just another early finish, hold the happily ever after. Bill Dean didn't describe their meeting in any detail. He only said, "They met at the field. She was running out the beer, and he helped her out of a bog hole when she got her handcart stuck." Maddie never said anything at all about that part of it, so I don't know much. Except I do. And although some of the details might be wrong, I'd bet you $1 to $100 I got most of them right. That was my summer for knowing things I had no business knowing. It's hot, for one thing. 94 is the hottest summer of the decade, and July is the hottest month of the summer. President Clinton is being upstaged by Newt and the Republicans. Folks are saying old Slick Willie may not even run for a second term. Boris Yeltsin is reputed to be either dying of heart disease or in a dryout clinic. The Red Sox are looking better than they have any right to. In Derry, Joanna Arlen Noonan is maybe starting to feel a little whoopsie in the morning. If so, she does not speak of it to her husband. I see Maddie in her blue polo shirt with her name sewn in white script above her left breast. Her white shorts make a pleasing contrast to her tanned legs. I also see her wearing a blue gimme cap with the red W for Warrington's above the long bill. Her pretty, dark blonde hair is pulled through the hole at the back of the cap and falls to the collar of her shirt. I see her trying to yank the handcart out of the mud without upsetting the keg of beer. Her head is down. The shadow thrown by the bill of the cap obscures all of her face but her mouth and small, set chin. "Let me help," Lance says, and she looks up. The shadow cast by the cap's bill falls away. He sees her big blue eyes, the ones she'll pass on to their daughter. One look into those eyes, and the war is over without a single shot fired. He belongs to her as surely as any young man ever belonged to any young woman. The rest, as they say around here, was just courtin'. The old man had 3 children, but Lance was the only one he seemed to care about. "Daughter's crazy in a shithouse mouse," Bill said matter-of-factly. "In some laughing academy in Washington State. Think I heard she caught her a cancer, too." The fact that Lance had no interest in computers and software actually seemed to please his father. He had another son who was capable of running the business. In another way, however, Lance DeVore's older half-brother wasn't capable at all. There would be no grandchildren from that one. "Rump wrangler," Bill said. "Understand there's a lot of that going around out there in California." There was a fair amount of it going around on the TR, too, I imagine, but thought it not my place to offer sexual instruction to my caretaker. Lance DeVore had been attending Reed College in Oregon, majoring in forestry, the kind of guy who falls in love with green flannel pants, red suspenders, and the sight of condors at dawn. A Brothers Grimm woodcutter, in fact, once you got past the academic jargon. In the summer between his junior and senior years, his father had summoned him to the family compound in Palm Springs and had presented him with a boxing lawyer's suitcase crammed with maps, aerial photos, and legal papers. These had little order that Lance could see, but I doubt that he cared. Imagine a comic book collector given a crate crammed with rare old copies of Donald Duck. Imagine a movie collector given the rough cut of a never-released film starring Humphrey Bogart and Marilyn Monroe. Then imagine this avid young forester realizing that his father owned not just acres or square miles in the vast unincorporated forests of western Maine, but entire realms. Although Max DeVore had left the TR in 1933, he'd kept a lively interest in the area where he'd grown up, subscribing to area newspapers and getting magazines such as Down East and the Maine Times. In the early 80s, he had begun to buy long columns of land just east of the Maine-New Hampshire border. God knew there had been plenty for sale. The paper companies, which owned most of it, had fallen into a recessionary pit, and many had become convinced that their New England holdings and operations would be the best place to begin retrenching. So this land, stolen from the Indians and clear-cut ruthlessly in the 20s and 50s, came into Max DeVore's hands. He might have bought it just because it was there, a good bargain he could afford to take advantage of. He might have bought it as a way of demonstrating to himself that he had really survived his childhood, had, in point of fact, triumphed over it. Or he might have bought it as a toy for his beloved younger son. In the years when DeVore was making his major land purchases in western Maine, Lance would have been just a kid, but old enough for a perceptive father to see where his interests were tending. DeVore asked Lance to spend the summer of 1994 surveying purchases which were, for the most part, already 10 years old. He wanted the boy to put the paperwork in order, but he wanted more than that. He wanted Lance to make sense of it. It wasn't a land use recommendation he was looking for exactly, although I guess he would have listened if Lance had wanted to make one. He simply wanted a sense of what he had purchased. Would Lance take a summer in western Maine trying to figure out what his sense of it was, at a salary of $2,000 or $3,000 a month? I imagine Lance's reply was a more polite version of Buddy Jellison's "Does a crow shit in the pine tops?" The kid arrived in June of 1994 and set up shop in a tent on the far side of Dark Score Lake. He was due back at Reed in late August. Instead, though, he decided to take a year's leave of absence. His father wasn't pleased. His father smelled what he called girl trouble. "Yeah, but it's a damn long sniff from California to Maine," Bill Dean said, leaning against the driver's door of his truck with his sunburned arms folded. "He had someone a lot closer than Palm Springs doing his sniffing for him." "What are you talking about?" I asked. "About talk. People do it for free, and most are willing to do even more if they're paid." "People like Royce Merrill?" "Royce might be one," he agreed, "but he wouldn't be the only one. Times around here don't go between bad and good. If you're a local, they mostly go between bad and worse. So when a guy like Max DeVore sends a guy out with a supply of $50 and $100 bills, was it someone local? A lawyer?" "Not a lawyer, a realtor named Richard Osgood. A greasy kind of fella," was Bill Dean's judgment of him, "who denned and did business in Mauton." Eventually, Osgood had hired a lawyer from Castle Rock. The greasy fella's initial job, when the summer of 94 ended and Lance DeVore remained on the TR, was to find out what the hell was going on and put a stop to it. "And then?" I asked. Bill glanced at his watch, glanced at the sky, then centered his gaze on me. He gave a funny little shrug as if to say, "We're both men of the world," in a quiet and settled sort of way. "You don't need to ask a silly question like that." "Then, Lance DeVore and Matty Stanchfield got married in the Grace Baptist Church right up there on Highway 68. There were tales made the rounds about what Osgood might have done to keep it from coming off. I heard he even tried to bribe Reverend Gooch into refusing to hitch him, but I think that's stupid. They just would have gone someplace else. Besides, I don't see much sense in repeating what I don't know for sure." Bill unfolded an arm and began to tick items off on the leathery fingers of his right hand. "They got married in the middle of January 1995. I know that." Out popped the thumb. "People looked around with some curiosity to see if the groom's father would put in an appearance, but he never did." Out popped the forefinger. Added to the thumb, it made a pistol. Maddie had a baby in late August of 95, making the kitty 2 months premature, except it was no more premature than corn in August. I seen it in the store with my own eyes when it wasn't a week old, and it was just the right size. Out with the second finger. I don't know that Lance DeVore's old man absolutely refused to help him financially, but I do know they were living in that trailer down below Dickie's garage, and that makes me think they was having a pretty hard skate. DeVore put on the choke chain, I said. It's what a guy used to getting his own way would do. But if he loved the boy the way you seem to think, he might have come around. Maybe, maybe not. He glanced at his watch again. Let me finish up quick and get out of your sunshine. But you ought to hear one more little story, because it really shows how the land lies. In July of last year, less than a month before he died, Lance DeVore shows up at the post office counter in the Lakeview General. He's got a manila envelope he wants to send, but first he needs to show Carla DeSensis what's inside. She said he was all fluffed out like daddies sometimes get over their kids when they're small. I nodded, amused at the idea of skinny, stuttering Lance DeVore all fluffed out. But I could see it in my mind's eye, and the image was also sort of sweet. It was a studio picture they'd gotten taken over in the Rock. Showed the kid. What's her name? Kayla? Kyra. Yeah, they call them anything these days, don't they? It showed Kyra sitting in a big leather chair with a pair of joke spectacles on a little snub of a nose, looking at one of the aerial photos of the woods over across the lake in TR-100 or TR-110. Part of what the old man had picked up, anyway. Carla said the baby had a surprised look on her face, as if she hadn't suspected there could be so much woods in the whole world. Said it was awful cunning, she did. Cunning as a cat a-running, I murmured. And the envelope, registered, express mail, was addressed to Maxwell DeVore in Palm Springs, California. Leading you to deduce that the old man either thought enough to ask for a picture of his only grandchild, or that Lance DeVore thought a picture might thaw him. Bill nodded, looking as pleased as a parent whose child has managed a difficult sum. Don't know if it did, he said. Wasn't enough time to tell one way or the other. Lance had bought one of those little satellite dishes like what you got here. There was a bad storm the day he put it up. Hail, high wind, blowdowns along the lake shore, lots of lightning. That was along toward evening. Lance put his dish up in the afternoon, all done and safe, except around the time the storm commenced, he remembered he'd left his socket wrench on the trailer roof. He went up to get it so it wouldn't get all wet and rusty. He was struck by lightning? Jesus, Bill. Lightning struck all right, but it hit across the way. You go past the place where Wasp Hill Road runs into 68, and you'll see the stump of the tree that stroke knocked over. Lance was coming down the ladder with his socket wrench when it hit. If you've never had a lightning bolt tear right over your head, you don't know how scary it is. It's like having a drunk driver veer across into your lane, headed right for you, and then swing back onto his own side just in time. Close lightning makes your hair stand up, makes your damn prick stand up. It's apt to play the radio on your steel fillings, it makes your ears hum, and it makes the air taste roasted. Lance fell off the ladder. If he had time to think anything before he hit the ground, I bet he thought he was electrocuted. Poor boy. He loved the TR, but it wasn't lucky for him. Broke his neck? Yeah. With all the thunder, Maddie never heard him fall or yell or anything. She looked out a minute or two later when it started to hail and he still wasn't in. And there he was, laying on the ground and looking up into the friggin' hail with his eyes open. Bill looked at his watch one final time, then swung open the door to his truck. The old man wouldn't come for their wedding, but he came for his son's funeral and he's been here ever since. He didn't want nothing to do with the young woman. But he wants the kid, I said. It was no more than what I already knew, but I felt a sinking in the pit of my stomach just the same. Don't talk about this, Maddie had asked me on the morning of the 4th. It's not a good time for Kai and me. How far along in the process has he gotten? On the third turn and heading into the home stretch, I should say. There's a hearing in Castle County Superior Court later this month. The judge could rule then to hand the girl over or put it off until October. I don't think it matters which, because the one thing that's never going to happen on God's green earth is a ruling in favor of the mother. One way or another, that little girl is going to grow up in California. Put that way, it gave me a very nasty little chill. Bill slid behind the wheel of his truck. "Stay out of it, Mike," he said. "Stay away from Maddie DeVore and her daughter. And if you get called to court on account of seeing the two of them on Saturday, smile a lot and say as little as you can. Max DeVore is charging that she's unfit to raise the child." "Aya." "Bill, I saw the child, and she's fine." He grinned again, but this time there was no amusement in it. "Imagine she is, but that's not the point. Stay clear of their business, old boy. It's my job to tell you that. With Joe gone, I guess I'm the only caretaker you got." He slammed the door of his Ram, started the engine, reached for the gear shift, then dropped his hand again as something else occurred to him. "If you get a chance, you ought to look for the owls." "What owls?" "There's a couple of plastic owls around here someplace. They might be in your basement or out in Joe's studio. They come in by mail order the fall before she passed on."
"The fall of 1993?
"Aya, that can't be right. We hadn't used Sarah in the fall of 1993. 'Tis, though. I was down here putting on the storm doors when Joe showed up. We had us a natter, and then the UPS truck come. I lugged the box into the entry and had a coffee. I was still drinking it then, while she took the owls out of the cat and showed them off to me. Gorry, but they looked real. She left not 10 minutes after. It was like she'd come down to do that errand special, although why anyone would drive all the way from Derry to take delivery of a couple of plastic owls, I don't know."
"When in the fall was it, Bill? Do you remember?"
"Second week of November," he said promptly. "Me and the wife went up to Lewiston later that afternoon to vet sisters. It was her birthday. On our way back, we stopped at the Castle Rock Agway so Vet could get her Thanksgiving turkey."
He looked at me curiously. "You really didn't know about them owls?"
"No."
"That's a touch peculiar, wouldn't you say?"
"Maybe she told me and I forgot," I said. "I guess it doesn't matter much now in any case."
Yet it seemed to matter. It was a small thing, but it seemed to matter.
Why would Joe want a couple of plastic owls to begin with?
"To keep the crows from shitting up the woodwork, like they're doing out on your deck. Crows see those plastic owls, they veer off."
I burst out laughing in spite of my puzzlement, or perhaps because of it.
"Yeah? That really works?"
"Yeah, long as you move them every now and then so's the crows don't get suspicious. Crows are just about the smartest birds going, you know. But you look for those owls. Save yourself a lot of mess."
"I will," I said. Plastic owls to scare the crows away. It was exactly the sort of knowledge Joe would come by. She was like a crow herself in that way, picking up glittery pieces of information that happened to catch her interest, and act upon without bothering to tell me. All at once, I was lonely for her again, missing her like hell.
"Good. I'll be down later this week when I've got more time, and we'll walk the place all the way around. Woods, too, if you want. I think you'll be satisfied."
"I'm sure I will. Where's DeVore staying?"
The bushy eyebrows went up.
"Warrington's. Him and you's practically neighbors. I thought you must know."
I remembered the white-haired woman I'd seen, black bathing suit top and black shorts somehow combining to give her an exotic cocktail party look, and nodded. "I think I met his wife." Bill laughed heartily enough at that to feel in need of his handkerchief. He fished it off the dashboard, a blue paisley thing the size of a football pennant, and wiped his eyes.
"What's so funny?" I asked.
"Skinny woman, white hair, looks sort of like that picture of a fella running across a bridge and yowling his head off."
It was my turn to laugh.
"That's her."
Yeah, but she's not his wife. His wife's been dead 20 years. She's his, personal assistant. Roget Whitmore is her name.
He pronounced it Roguette, with a hard G.
What kind of name is that? French?
California, he said, and shrugged as if that one word explained everything. There's people in town scared of her.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Bill hesitated, then added with one of those smiles we put on when we want others to know that we know we're saying something silly.
Bertha Meserve says she's a witch.
And they've been staying at Warrington's almost a year? DeVore's elder son must be minding the store, huh?
The Whitmore woman only joined him for good last month, Bill said. Thinking in town is that she'll stay until the custody business is finished off, and then they'll all go back to California on DeVore's private jet. Leave Osgood to sell Warrington's and...
Sell it? What do you mean, sell it?
I thought you must know, Bill said, dropping his gear shift into drive. When old Hugh Emerson told DeVore they closed the lodge after Thanksgiving, DeVore told him he had no intention of moving, said he was comfortable right where he was and meant to stay put.
He bought the place.
I had been by turns surprised, amused, and angered over the last 20 minutes, but never exactly dumbfounded. Now I was. He bought Warrington's lodge so we wouldn't have to move to Lookout Rock Hotel over in Castle View or rent a house.
Yeah, so he did. 9 buildings, including the main lodge and the Sunset Bar. 12 acres of woods, a 6-hole golf course, and 500 feet of shorefront along the street, plus a 2-lane bowling alley and a softball field. $4.25 million. His friend Osgood did the deal, and DeVore paid with a personal check. I wonder how he found room for all those zeros. I'll see you, Mike.
With that, he backed up the driveway, leaving me to stand on the stoop, looking after him with my mouth open. Plastic Owls. Bill had told me roughly 24 interesting things in between peeks at his watch, but the one which stayed on top of the pile was the fact, and I did accept it as a fact, he had been too positive for me not to, that Joe had come down here to take delivery on a couple of plastic goddamn owls.
Had she told me?
She might have. I didn't remember her doing so, and it seemed to me that I would have. But Joe used to claim that when I got into the zone, it was no good to tell me anything. Stuff went in one ear and out the other. Sometimes she'd pin little notes, errands to run, calls to make, to my shirt, as if I were a first grader. But wouldn't I recall if she'd said, "I'm going down to Sarah, hon. UPS is delivering something I want to receive personally. Interested in keeping a lady company?" Hell, wouldn't I have gone? I always liked an excuse to go to the TR. Except I'd been writing those stories, trying to put together a collection and maybe pushing it a little. Notes pinned to the sleeve of my shirt. "If you go out when you're finished, we need milk and orange juice." I inspected what little was left of Joe's vegetable garden, with July sun beating down on my neck, and thought about the owls, the plastic goddamn owls. Suppose Joe had told me she was coming down here, to Sarah laughs. Suppose I had declined almost without hearing the offer because I was in the writing zone. Even if you granted those things, there was another question. Why had she felt the need to come down here personally, when she could have just called someone and asked them to meet the delivery truck? Kenny Oster would have been happy to do it. Ditto Mrs. M. And Bill Dean, our caretaker, had actually been here. This led to other questions. One was why she hadn't just had UPS deliver the damn things to Derry. And finally, I decided I couldn't live without actually seeing a bona fide plastic owl for myself. Maybe, I thought, going back to the house, I'd put one on the roof of my Chevy when it was parked in the driveway, forestall future bombing runs. I paused in the entry, struck by a sudden idea, and called Ward Hankins, the guy in Waterville who handles my taxes and my few non-writing-related business affairs.
"Mike," he said heartily, "how's the lake?"
"The lake's cool and the weather's hot, just the way we like it," I said. "Ward, you keep all the records we send you for 5 years, don't you, just in case IRS decides to give us some grief?" Five is accepted practice, he said, but I hold your stuff for 7. In the eyes of the tax boys, you're a mighty fat pigeon. Better a fat pigeon than a plastic owl, I thought, but didn't say. What I said was, that includes desk calendars, right? Mine and Joe's, up until she died? You bet. Since neither of you kept diaries, it was the best way to cross-reference receipts and claimed expenses with... Could you find Joe's desk calendar for 1993 and see what she had going in the second week of November? I'd be happy to. What in particular are you looking for? For a moment, I saw myself sitting at my kitchen table in Derry on my first night as a widower, holding up a box with the words Norco Home Pregnancy Test printed on the side. Exactly what was I looking for at this late date? Considering that I had loved the lady and she was almost 4 years in her grave, what was I looking for? Besides trouble, that was. I'm looking for 2 plastic owls, I said. Ward probably thought I was talking to him, but I'm not sure I was. I know that sounds weird, but it's what I'm doing. Can you call me back? Within the hour. Good man, I said, and hung up. Now, for the actual owls themselves. What was the most likely spot to store 2 such interesting artifacts? My eyes went to the cellar door. Elementary, my dear Watson. The cellar stairs were dark and mildly dank. As I stood on the landing, groping for the light switch, the door banged shut behind me with such force that I cried out in surprise. There was no breeze, no draft. The day was perfectly still, but the door banged shut just the same, or was sucked shut. I stood in the dark at the top of the stairs, feeling for the light switch, smelling that oozy smell that even good concrete foundations get after a while, if there is no proper airing out. It was cold in here, much colder than it should have been, and much colder than it had been, when I stepped through from the kitchen. All at once, I was at Manderley again, which is only to say that I wasn't alone and knew it. I was afraid I'd be a liar to say I wasn't, but I was also fascinated. Something was with me. Something was with me. I dropped my hand away from the wall where the switch was and just stood with my arms at my sides. Some time passed, I don't know how much. My heart was beating furiously in my chest. I could feel it thudding in my temples. It was cold. Hello? I asked. Nothing in response. I could hear the faint, irregular drip of water as condensation fell from one of the pipes down below. I could hear my own breathing, and faintly, far away in another world where the sun was out, I could hear the triumphant caw of a crow. Perhaps it had just dropped a load on the hood of my car. I really need an owl, I thought. In fact, I don't know how I ever got along without one. Hello, I asked again. Can you talk? Nothing. I wet my lips. I should have felt silly, perhaps, standing there in the dark and calling to the ghosts, but I didn't. Not a bit. The damp had been replaced by a coldness I could feel, and I had company. Oh, yes. Can you tap, then? If you can shut the door, you must be able to tap. I stood there and listened to the soft, isolated drips from the pipes. There was nothing else. I was reaching out for the light switch again when there was a soft thud from not far below me. The cellar of Sarah Laughs is high, and the upper 3 feet of the concrete, the part which lies against the ground's frost belt, had been insulated with big silver-backed panels of InsuGuard. The sound that I heard was, I am quite sure, a fist striking against one of these. Just a fist hitting a square of insulation, but every gut and muscle of my body seemed to come unwound. I can hardly believe I didn't load my pants. My hair stood up. My eye socket seemed to be expanding, and my eyeballs contracting as if my head were trying to turn into a skull. Every inch of my skin broke out in goose flesh. Something was in here with me. something dead. I could no longer have turned on the light if I wanted to. I no longer had the strength to raise my arm. I tried to talk, and at first I couldn't raise a voice either. At last, in a husky whisper I hardly recognized, I said, "Are you there? Really there?" Thud. "Who are you?" I could still do no better than that husky whisper, the voice of a man giving last instructions to his family as he lies on his deathbed. This time there was nothing from below. I tried to think, and what came to my struggling mind was Tony Curtis as Harry Houdini in some old movie. According to the film, Houdini had been the Diogenes of the Ouija board circuit, a guy who spent his spare time just looking for an honest medium. He'd attended one seance where the dead communicated by... "Tap once for yes, twice for no," I said. "Can you do that?" Thud. It was on the stairs below me, but not too far below. 5 steps down, 6 or 7 at the most. Not quite close enough to touch if I should reach out and wave my hand in the black basement air. A thing I could imagine, but not actually imagine doing. "Are you?" My voice trailed off. There was simply no strength in my diaphragm. Chilly air lay on my chest like a flat iron. I gathered all my will and tried again. "Are you Joe?" Thud. That soft fist on the insulation. A pause, and then thud, thud. Yes and no. Then, with no idea why I was asking such an inane question, "Are the owls down here?" Thud, thud. "Do you know where they are?" Thud. "Should I look for them?" Thud. Very hard. Hot fingers touched my eyes, and I almost screamed before realizing it was sweat. I raised my cold hands in the dark and wiped the heels of them up my face to the hairline. They skidded as if in oil. Cold or not, I was all but bathing in my own sweat. "Are you Lance DeVore?" Thud, thud, at once. No. "Is it safe for me at Sarah? Am I safe?" Thud. A pause, and I knew it was a pause, that the thing on the stairs wasn't finished. Then, thud, thud. Yes, I was safe. No, I wasn't safe. An idea came to me then. I wasn't alone, that much was true, but it wasn't a ghost talking to me any more than the spirits of the dead had ever spoken to Harry Houdini. This was some trick of DeVore's, maybe even some new computer program he'd worked up. Call it ghost thumping. Part of my mind knew that wasn't true. The temperature on the landing seemed to have dropped 20 degrees, and I was shivering. But the other part was sure it was. I had regained control of my arm. I reached out, felt along the wall, and at last found the light switch. I settled my fingers on it. Now the sweat on my face felt as if it were turning to ice. "Are you the person who cries in the night?" I asked. Thud, thud from below me, and between the two thuds I flicked the switch. The cellar globes came on. So did a brilliant hanging bulb, at least 125 watts, over the landing. There was no time for anyone to hide, let alone get away, and no one there to try either. Also, Mrs. Meserve, admirable in so many ways, had neglected to sweep the cellar stairs. When I went down 5 risers to where I estimated the thudding sounds had been coming from, I left heel smudges in the light dust, but mine were the only marks. I blew out breath in front of me and could see it, so it had been cold, still was cold, but it was warming up fast. I blew out another breath and could see just a hint of fog. A third exhale, and there was nothing. I ran my palm over one of the insulated squares. Smooth. I pushed a finger at it, and although I didn't push with any real force, my finger left a dimple in the silvery surface, easy as pie. If someone had been thumping a fist down here, This stuff should be pitted, the thin silver skin perhaps even broken to reveal the pink fill underneath. But all the squares were smooth. "Are you still there?" I asked. No response, and yet I had a sense that my visitor was still there, somewhere. "I hope I didn't offend you by turning on the light," I said, and now I did feel slightly weird, standing a quarter of the way down my cellar stairs, talking out loud, sermonizing to the spiders. "I wanted to see you if I could." I had no idea if that was true or not. Suddenly, so suddenly I almost lost my balance and tumbled down the stairs. I whirled around, convinced the shroud creature was behind me, that it had been the thing knocking. It! No polite M.R. James ghost, but a horror which had come out of the ground like a stinking tooth out of a putrid gum. There was nothing. I turned around again, took two or three deep, steadying breaths, and then went the rest of the way down the cellar stairs. Beneath them was a perfectly serviceable kayak, complete with jolly red paddle. In the corner was the gas stove we'd replaced with an electric range after buying the place. Also the clawfoot tub Joe had wanted, over my objections, to turn into a planter. I found a trunk filled with table linen I remembered from the 70s, a group of mildewy 8-track tapes from the same decade, groups like Parliament, Funkadelic, and 38 Special, several cartons of old dishes. There was a life down here, but ultimately not a very interesting one. Unlike the life I'd sensed in Joe's studio, this one hadn't been cut short, but evolved out of, shed like old skin, and that was all right. Was, in fact, the natural order of things. There was a photo album on a shelf of knick-knacks, mostly Joe's short-lived efforts at ceramics, a craft for which she'd simply had no touch, and I took it down, both curious and wary. No bombs this time, however. Nearly all the pics were landscape shots of Sarah Laughs, as it had been when we bought it. I found a picture of Joe in bell-bottoms, though, her hair parted in the middle and white lipstick on her mouth, and one of Michael Noonan wearing a flowered shirt and mutton-chop sideburns that made the current me cringe. The Mike Noonan in the photo was a Barry White kind of guy I didn't want to recognize and yet did. I found Joe's old broken treadmill, a rake I'd want if I was still around here come fall, a snowblower I'd want even more if I was around come winter, and several cans of paint. What I didn't find were any plastic owls. My insulation-thumping pal had been right. Upstairs, the telephone started ringing. I hurried to answer it, going out through the cellar door and then reaching back in to flick off the light switch. This amused me and at the same time seemed like perfectly normal behavior, just as being careful not to step on sidewalk cracks had seemed like perfectly normal behavior to me when I was a kid. And even if it wasn't normal, what did it matter? I'd only been back at Sarah for 3 days, but already I'd postulated Noonan's first law of eccentricity. When you're on your own, strange behavior really doesn't seem strange at all. I snagged the cordless. "Hello?" "Hi, Mike. It's Ward." That was quick. "The file room's just a short walk down the hall," he said, "easy as pie. There's only one thing on Joe's calendar for the second week of November in 1993. It says, SKs of Maine, Freep, 11 a.m. That's on Tuesday the 13th. Does it help?" "Yes," I said. "Thank you, Ward. It helps a lot." I broke the connection and put the phone back in its cradle. Yes, it helped. SKs of Maine was Soup Kitchens of Maine. Joe had been on their board of directors from 1992 until her death. Freep was Freeport. It must have been a board meeting. They had probably discussed plans for feeding the homeless on Thanksgiving, and then Joe had driven the 70 or so miles to the TR in order to take delivery of 2 plastic owls. It didn't answer all the questions, but aren't there always questions in the wake of a loved one's death, and no statute of limitations on when they come up? The UFO voice spoke up then. "While you're right here by the phone," it said, "why not call Bonnie Mudson? Say hi. See how she's doing." Joe had been on 4 different boards during the 90s, all of them doing charitable work. Her friend Bonnie had persuaded her onto the soup kitchen's board when a seat fell vacant. They had gone to a lot of the meetings together. Not the one in November of 1993, presumably, and Bonnie could hardly be expected to remember that one particular meeting almost 5 years later. But if she saved her old minutes of the meeting sheets... Exactly what the fuck was I thinking of? Calling Bonnie, making nice, then asking her to check her December minutes? Was I going to ask her if the attendance report had my wife absent from the November meeting? Was I going to ask if maybe Joe had seemed different that last year of her life? And when Bonnie asked me why I wanted to know, what would I say? Give me that, Joe had snarled in my dream of her. In that dream, she hadn't looked like Joe at all. She'd looked like some other woman, maybe like the one in the Book of Proverbs, the strange woman whose lips were as honey, but whose heart was full of gall and wormwood. A strange woman with fingers as cold as twigs after a frost. Give me that. It's my dust catcher. I went to the cellar door and touched the knob. I turned it, then let it go. I didn't want to look down there into the dark. Didn't want to risk the chance that something might start thumping again. It was better to leave that door shut. What I wanted was something cold to drink. I went into the kitchen, reached for the fridge door, then stopped. The magnets were back in a circle again, but this time 4 letters and 1 number had been pulled into the center and lined up there. They spelled a single lowercase word. Hello. There was something here. Even back in broad daylight, I had no doubt of that. I'd asked if it was safe for me to be here and had received a mixed message, but that didn't matter. If I left Sarah now, there was nowhere to go. I had a key to the house in Derry, but matters had to be resolved here. I knew that, too. Hello, I said, and opened the fridge to get a soda. Whoever or whatever you are, hello. I woke in the early hours of the following morning, convinced that there was someone in the north bedroom with me. I sat up against the pillows, rubbed my eyes, and saw a dark, shouldery shape standing between me and the window. "Who are you?" I asked, thinking that it wouldn't reply in words. It would instead thump on the wall. Once for yes, twice for no. "What's on your mind, Houdini?" But the figure standing by the window made no reply at all. I groped up, found the string hanging from the light over the bed, and yanked it. My mouth was turned down in a grimace, my midsection tensed so tight it felt as if bullets would have bounced off. "Oh, shit," I said. "Fuck me till I cry." Dangling from a hanger I'd hooked over the curtain rod was my old suede jacket. I'd parked it there while unpacking and had then forgotten to store it away in the closet. I tried to laugh and couldn't. At 3 in the morning, it just didn't seem that funny. I turned off the light and lay back down with my eyes open, waiting for Bunter's bell to ring or the childish sobbing to start. I was still listening when I fell asleep. 7 hours or so later, as I was getting ready to go out to Joe's studio and see if the plastic owls were in the storage area, where I hadn't checked the day before, a late model Ford rolled down my driveway and stopped nose to nose with my Chevy. I had gotten as far as the short path between the house and the studio, but now I came back. The day was hot and breathless, and I was wearing nothing but a pair of cut-off jeans and plastic flip-flops on my feet. Joe always claimed that the Cleveland style of dressing divided itself naturally into 2 subgenres, full Cleveland and Cleveland casual. My visitor that Tuesday morning was wearing Cleveland casual. You had your Hawaiian shirt with pineapples and monkeys, your tan slacks from Banana Republic, your white loafers. Socks are optional, but white footgear is a necessary part of the Cleveland look, as is at least 1 piece of gaudy gold jewelry. This fellow was totally okay in the ladder department. He had a Rolex on one wrist and a gold link chain around his neck. The tail of his shirt was out, and there was a suspicious lump at the back. It was either a gun or a beeper and looked too big to be a beeper. I glanced at the car again. Black wall tires. And on the dashboard, oh, look at this, a covered blue bubble. The better to creep up on you unsuspected, Grandma.